Good evening, everybody. For those of you who I haven't met yet, my name's Levi Cooper. I'm a teacher here at Pardes. I've been a teacher here for some 15 years. You'll notice I don't have an accent. I'm originally from Australia. And so if I say anything in any language or lack of accent that isn't clear, feel free to stop me at any stage. I live with my family in Sur Hadassah, just outside Yerushalayim. And I'm very happy to kick off this three-part mini-series. This series is dedicated, as I'm sure you know, to the Magid of Mizrich. And what we're going to do over our three meetings is to try and understand who the Magid of Mizrich was. What was his contribution? Why is he a person who might be significant for us? And how does he fit into Jewish history? What do we know about him? And what would we like to know about him? All that and more in three short meetings. This week is the first week. We'll meet again in 2 weeks' time. Next week's Ta'anit Esther, or Purim already, outside of Yerushalayim, so we won't be meeting. We'll meet again in 2 weeks, and then the week after that will be the final meeting. Each meeting will meet here at 8 o'clock. We'll go through till 9:15, and we'll pack in as much as we can. I have a lot of material. I do want to share with you that this is the first time that I'm publicly teaching this topic. So on one hand, I'm a little bit nervous, but I'm also a bit excited because scholarship on the Magid of Mizrich is very scarce. So let's start off with who is the Magid of Mizrich. If we go back to the late 18th century, the formative period of the Hasidic movement, the most influential and important figure in that period, who would that be? The Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov. Hands down, the Baal Shem Tov. And I know some of you, I recognize some of the faces here, some of you will say, we learnt about the Baal Shem Tov last year. That's right. The mini-series last year was dedicated to the Baal Shem Tov. The second most important person in Hasidic tradition is Rav Dov Ber, the Magid of Mizrich. And we're going to try to understand who he was and what he did and what was his legacy. Is anybody in the wrong place? You all came to... Okay. So, let's begin with where was the Magid active? Here we've got a map. The map is taken from the Encyclopedia Judaica. I've circled Mezhibuzh. Mezhibuzh is the city of the Baal Shem Tov. Okay, we're not talking about the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov died in 1760. Where's the Magid of Mizrich? Where's Mizrich? You can see Mizrich is over there. Everyone see? Now, what is this move? Is this a significant move? On the map, it doesn't look so significant, but this isn't a good map for indicating how significant this move, this geographic move was. This is a map of modern Ukraine, maybe. I haven't heard the news today. Okay, and the highlighted area is Podolia, and that is an indication where Mezhibuzh is. Now, if I then show you the next map, this area is Volhynia. Two different areas within what's today Ukraine, then in the Russian Empire. And that is where Mizrich is. This move from Podolia to Volhynia is a move towards Poland. Okay? Towards Poland, towards this more central Europe. So what the Magid has done geographically, without even talking about his personality, just as far as the brand name, Mezhibuzh, as opposed to Mizrich, is a move towards a geographic center. Is that clear? Is that significant? Is that a significant move? Here we can see it on an older map. Whoop. Okay, there you can see Mezhibuzh in Podolia and a move to Mizrich in Volhynia. Is that a significant move? What do you reckon?
It seems so.
Why?
Closer to the Jews.
Good. What else does it indicate to us about the development of Hasidus? It's spreading. Not just it's spreading, what else is it becoming? It's not just spreading, right? It could have moved to Australia and then it would be spreading. We might not be so impressed with that. Although we'd be playing cricket now.
And tomorrow.
Sorry? Unless you know. So I've already told you that the Jewish population is... this move is a move towards the centers of Jewish leadership and the bigger areas of bigger Jewish population centers. Lauren, it's in higher demand, and it's also, I want to add one more word to what you've said. It's also becoming part of the mainstream. It's no longer on the outskirts. It's no longer this movement that is really big in Mitzpeh Ramon, right? This is something that's moved to the center, to Jerusalem, just to give an example, right? It's moving in that direction, and it's an indication of Hasidism's mobility, it's an indication of its dissemination, and an indication of its mainstreamization. I made that word up. Okay. What did the Maggid look like? Do we know what he looked like? We just want to get the facts on the ground. So in 1927, a book, a Yiddish work by a guy called Gershon Bader, 30 generations of Jews in Poland. And in this Yiddish work, he publishes this picture of Rav Dov Ber, and he writes at the bottom that this is a picture of Rav Dov Ber, the Maggid of Mizrich. The Maggid of Mizrich died in 1772. This book is printed in 1927. The first time we have a picture of the Maggid of Mizrich. Reliable? Well, that's not what everybody else seemed to think, because after 1927, it was then copied. This is a work from 1933, printed in Lodz. And a number of other works that I found, this reproduction, a reproduction of this picture, and each time it's indicated, Hamagid Mizrich, that indeed this is a likeness of the Maggid of Mizrich. Alas, we also have the original. And the original picture, this is the picture, is a picture by a photographer that we know, Tzadok Basan, who took this picture of Rabbi Shmuel Salant. Rabbi Shmuel Salant. Who's Rabbi Shmuel Salant? Not Salanta. Rabbi Shmuel Salant, Ashkenazi chief rabbi here in Jerusalem at the turn of the century. And this is one of... And Tzadok Basan was, before he became a famous photographer, he was a student in the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva. He takes this photograph right... In the final years of Rabbi Shmuel Salant, and you'll notice at the bottom it says, "Tmunazo nasta rak letovat Eitz Chaim Haklali." This picture is made as a fundraising effort for Eitz Chaim Haklali, for the institution Eitz Chaim. Ve'en reshut l'shum yachid u'mosad la'atik, and there's no permission for anybody or institution to copy it. And yet, and what's fascinating is, I told you it's 1927, so the picture's reused under a different name in the lifetime of the very photographer. So what did the Maggid look like? We have no idea.
Looks like the Rambam.
It's like the picture of the Rambam on the Machberet.
The picture of the Rambam is another lecture entirely, and I'd be happy to share that with you in a different mini-series. I had a chance two summers ago here in the Executive Seminar to give a session on the image of the Rambam, and stamps from all over the world that have used that likeness of the Rambam. But that is beyond the scope this evening. There's a little plug for the Executive Learning Seminar. Okay, so we can't see the Maggid, but who did see the Maggid? His followers, right? His followers. But I'm interested, before we get to his followers, is there any non-Hasidic evidence of the Maggid? Do we have any independent contemporary evidence of the Maggid? Is there anyone who saw the Maggid besides those people who were his followers? Someone who is somewhat impartial that can tell us the story or give us something about the Maggid?
There must have been some.
And there was someone. Not Misnagdim, though. This predates the Misnagdim. Misnagdim is a different mini-series, perhaps next year. Solomon Maimon was a precocious young lad. At age 11, he was married after his parents had betrothed him to two girls to create a bidding war over the dowry. By the age of 14, he was already a father. And by 22, he had abandoned his family. He died later on in Germany, perhaps of alcoholism, but after publishing his autobiography and publishing important works on Immanuel Kant. And he's a serious philosopher, this Solomon Maimon. We're not interested today in the work of Immanuel Kant. We're fascinated by Solomon Maimon's biography. And this biography is published in Solomon Maimon's lifetime in 1792. And in chapter 19 of this biography, he has a section on Dinoya Hasidim, the new Hasidim. Now, in case any of you were sick the day they taught German in school, we're fortunate that it has been translated. And I just want to point out, if you have a look, who's it translated by? J. Clark Murray. Why is J. Clark Murray interested in translating Solomon Maimon's biography? Because Solomon Maimon is a very important person from the perspective of philosophy. So from a philosophical, for those who are studying Immanuel Kant, they want to understand what one of the great commentators of Kant, how he presented Immanuel Kant's work. But for us, we're not interested in the philosophical aspect. We're interested in his section on Hasidus. And in chapter 19, he tells us that he became acquainted with this sect called the New Hasidim, which was just then coming into prominence. And he points out that he describes the way Hasidim of old were people who were pietists. But this new group of Hasidim, they maintained that true piety does not by any means consist in chastisement of the body. In other words, he's saying to us that this new group that he's observed stands out from other Hasidim by the fact that they are not fasting, that they are enjoying life more. Now, does that fit the common view of the way we perceive or remember Hasidus today?
Some of them.
Of course it does. Hasidim dancing, Hasidim having alachayim, Hasidic song. So Solomon Maimon perceives this already when he's in Poland, around the late 1760s. And Solomon Maimon continues and he points out that fasts and vigils and the constant study of the Talmud are not only useless, but even prejudicial to that cheerfulness of spirit which is essential to genuine piety. So what he's done over here is he's honed in on what will become central tenets of Hasidus. He continues, and he says, at first the rabbis and the pietists opposed the spread of this sect. Who's he referring to? Who? So first of all, who said old Hasidim? Your name, ma'am?
Carmel.
Carmel says, pietists is referring to old Hasidim. That's excellent, Carmel. Hasidim exists already at that time. But they're not Hasidim with, I don't know, a capital Chet. They're not the Hasidim of the Baal Shem Tov that will come to know. These Hasidim are Hasidim of the old style, pietists. And they're against these new Hasidim and the rabbis. So who are these pietists and the rabbis? Historically, what will they become known as? The Misnagdim, the Mitnagdim. He doesn't have that term in his lexicon. in the 1760s. By the time that term becomes a term that everybody knows, he's already living in Germany and remembering what he saw in his childhood. Solomon Maimon says, you know, I heard about this group, but I didn't really know very much about them until I met with a young man. And that's an important point for us, because who did Hasidus originally attract? Actually not. It was not the simple uneducated, because the simple and uneducated had to work. It was more those people who were in a financial situation that they could just take time off, and they could explore, and they could rebel. So what type of people is it classically? You're going to say yeshiva bochim, young men. It was the classic or the mainstream of the early Hasidic movement. Why young men? You said yeshiva bochim. This is before yeshivas are popular in the way we know them today. These young men, when a person would get married, part of the deal was that his kest. What's kest?
Support
from father-in-law. From your father-in-law. That your father-in-law would say, part of the deal was, I will support you for X number of years. And what were you supposed to do during those X number of years?
Learn and make babies.
Learn. Right? And begin your family. But the idea was that you could start, you could learn. Now you have this freedom without the responsibility. This is an opportunity for you to go and explore the world. You hear about these new Hasidim that say that cheerfulness is the way to piety. And that is the initial people who are drawn to these new Hasidim that Solomon Maimon is describing to us. And Solomon Maimon says to this young man who passes through his town, he says, tell me about these new Hasidim. And the man says, look, I can't tell you about the constitution of the society. Now let me ask you a question. Why couldn't he tell Solomon Maimon about the constitution of the society? Because there wasn't a constitution of the society. This is Solomon Maimon already in Germany looking back saying, well, he didn't really explain to me exactly the structure. And the reason was because at this time there's no structure, or there isn't a structure yet. And he says, you're allowed to, in order to join, it's the simplest thing in the world. Any man who wants to can just come and be a member. You don't even need to give your resume. You don't need to give a medical certificate. You don't need any of that, because you'll just come to, and he calls the people superiors. Right, that's the translation. What we would call what? Rebbes. What we call Rebbes. What will really be called at this time, the Tzaddik. What will later be known as Admor. These masters, in English, the Hasidic masters. They will be able to understand your moral weaknesses. They could see into the human heart and discern everything that is concealed in its secret recesses. They could foretell the future and bring near at hand things that are remote. So this young man says to Solomon Maimon, these people have magical capabilities. Their sermons and moral teachings were not as these things commonly are, thought over and arranged in an orderly manner beforehand. That's a really important sentence. What's he describing? What will become known as the Tish. Will become known as the Tish, and we'll talk about that in a second. But who said spontaneous? Your name, ma'am?
Gabrielle.
Gabrielle said spontaneous. A spontaneous bursting forth of Torah. This is the exact opposite of the preparation that one puts into a drosha. And the early Hasidim were very critical of these drashot that were fire and brimstone. No. That's not the way we teach. It needs to be something that comes from within us. And these Hasidic masters, they taught in a different way entirely. They were tools for the Almighty's voice. And we'll come back to that theme in a moment. Solomon Maimon says to this young man, tell me what some of these Torahs are. Tell me what some of the teachings are. And the young man relates three different passages that he heard from these new Hasidim. We'll come back, I'm skipping them at the moment, we'll come back and learn one in a moment. Because we want to understand, is Solomon Maimon referring to something that we know? So far, what we can say is that he's describing things that sound familiar. But was he describing actually the Magid's court, the early Hasidim, or not? Wait and see. We'll come back to these three Torahs in a second. I could not help being astonished at the exquisite refinement of these thoughts and charmed with the ingenious exegesis by which they were supported. Solomon Maimon is totally taken by these ideas, and therefore he decides. What does he decide? I resolve, therefore, to undertake a journey to where the superior resided. Who's he talking about? Now, don't think that I'm the person who left the names out, because if you have a look in the original German, you can see over there, right, the M and the B. He doesn't tell us who he's talking about. Could it be that he's referring to the city of Mezrich, and who's the rabbi there? Ber. Could it be? Dov Ber? Could it be that this is who he's referring to? That's who the person who Solomon Maimon said he wanted to go to see? How could we prove that? The dates are fine. The dates work out. It's exactly when we know the Magid of Mizrich is active in Mizrich. What? First of all, who's they? Solomon Maimon's alive when he publishes this. I have. I don't know whether it's Solomon Maimon or an editor or the publisher. It certainly happens in Solomon Maimon's lifetime. I don't know why. Maybe I don't know why he leaves it out. I can tell you that I'm very annoyed, right? Nightmares about why this is left out, and you'll see it gets even worse, right? But so how could I prove whether this is the Magid of Mizrich?
If he has some writings and they match the three cases.
Excellent. Your name, sir?
Albert.
Albert's right. If I could find in the Magid's writings, and that matches the three Divrei Torah that young Solomon Maimon heard before he went to see Rabbi B in M, then it might be the same person. Brilliant. Alas, the Magid left no writings.
But someone else
may have. Very good, Carmel. Who might have left some writings? A student. Maybe a student has left some writings for us and has these passages. So let's first of all have a look at one of the three passages. We're not going to have time tonight to look at all of them. Let's have a look at one of them and learn one of them, because I think this is a key passage, as you'll see as we go on tonight. We're having a look at the second passage that he quotes. And it's a play on the Pasuk, K'nagan ha-menagen. When the minstrel played, the Spirit of God came upon him. A verse in Melachim, in Kings. And he explains. This is explained in the following way. As long as a man is self-active, he is incapable of receiving the influence of the Holy Ghost. Holy Ghost? That doesn't sound like our tradition.
Ruach HaKodesh,
right? So it's a translation of Ruach HaKodesh. Don't get confused. For this purpose, right? In other words, if he wants to receive the influence of Ruach HaKodesh, for this purpose, he must hold himself like an instrument in a purely passive state. The meaning of the passage is therefore this. When the minstrel, Hamenagen, the servant of God, becomes like his, I'm saying his own, his instrument, Kenagen, then the Spirit of God comes upon him. It's not such a clear passage. When we see another edition of another version of it, it'll become clearer. I just want to point out to you that what's fascinating to me is if you have a look at the original German, it actually has the Hebrew words there. You see that? See the Hebrew words? In the original German. So is this an authentic teaching of the Maggid? And as you correctly pointed out, I could look for it, perhaps, in writings of the students. Because the students of the Maggid did bequeath a number of different works. And the story with these three passages is that a scholar called Professor Weiss found two of them. He found one of them and published it in the 50s. And a couple of years later, he found a second one. And just within the last 10 years, the third passage was identified by another scholar, Professor David Asaf of Tel Aviv University. And indeed, we have all three passages. Let's have a look at what that looks like. Rabbi Uziel Meislich was a student of the Maggid, not a well-known student, but he left us two works, a halachic work called Menorah HaTorah, and a work of Hasidic Torah known as Tiferet Uziel. Both of these works are published in the 1880s, okay, about 100 years after he passed away. We might come back to that. In Tiferet Uziel, we have this passage that's entitled Kashofar Harem Kolecha, like a shofar, raise your voice, where he has an explanation of Kenagen Hamanagen in the name of? Let's have a look at what he says. Kashofar Harem Kolecha. Let's learn some Hasidic Torah tonight. Kashofar Harem Kolecha, you should raise your voice like a shofar. Lahavin zot, says Rav Uziel Meislich. To understand this, akdim, I will begin by saying the following. Masha shamati gamken, what I also heard, mi moriv rabbi hagon v'achasid, Dov Ber, that which I heard from Dov Ber, who has passed away already, on the verse, v'ya kenagan hamanagen v'tihi alav ruach elokim. What did the Maggid say about that verse? Dihine. Zenira le'enei kol adam hamanagen yafeh. This is obvious to any person who plays a musical instrument. Who plays a musical instrument here? What do you play?
Piano.
So our piano players here know that when they are playing piano, yesh lo kama pniot. You're focusing on the piano, but you're also sometimes thinking, I hope this sounds good. I hope the people are listening to me. I hope that the piano's tuned. I hope that the sound that I'm hitting the keys clearly. And the person's not just thinking about the music, but they're thinking also, what's everybody else thinking? Are they enjoying the performance or not? Lochein hakli shemenagenbo. That's not what's going through the mind of the piano. What's the piano thinking while Gabrielle is playing the piano? Nothing. Hu domem. The piano is silent. Ubevadai ein yecholet vakli lasot shum pnuya. The piano has no ability to be focused on anything else. Vezeh vayakenagan hamenagen. This is the meaning of the verse, that a person should be like a musical instrument that is being played. Retzonolomar, meaning, im yehaman again, if the musician, hu ha'adam, that's the person, ken again, will be like, what?
The instrument.
Retzonolomar, kehakli, like the instrument, shaman again, but that he's playing. Sha'af lo lo, that also for the person who's playing the instrument, lo ye shum pnuya k'moakli, he also won't be thinking about anything else, just like the instrument. Az vati alav ruach elokim. Then he will have the Spirit of God on him. So Rav Uziel Meislich tells us that the Maggid said the following Torah, and this is a very interesting Torah, as we'll see as we go along tonight. But at this stage, it's just interesting for the very simple reason that it matches what Solomon Maimon told us. Let's understand it just for a second. What is he saying? He's talking about a certain amount of passivity in service of God, as opposed to always being active and thinking, how can I do a good job? Do I look good? Of just letting the divine flow through you. Are there any questions at this point? Do you understand what Rav Uziel Maizvich has said? A sort of a bitul and a self-nullification that you no longer exist. But I think in some ways it's even more than a bitul. When you bitul, then there's something there. The piano doesn't have to be mevatel et atzmo, right? The piano doesn't need to go through any process of subjugating itself. It is just an instrument. Says the Magid, a person should be an instrument for the divine, rather than the whole time thinking about whether they've got a good performance. Now let's think for a second. Let's remember back. How did Solomon Maimon describe the drashot, the public Torahs of the new Hasidim? What did he say? Marsha? Spontaneous. This is exactly what he's being described over here. Something that's spontaneous. Not that I sat at home and I pulled off all the books on my shelf and I put together a great drasha that I thought, this is a tearjerker. This is a great story. This will get a laugh in the middle. Says the Magid, that's not the way we teach, we do Torah as new Hasidim. We are spontaneously inspired by the divine. You with me? Yes? So I think that this is a nice Torah, a lovely idea, and we'll come back to the idea. But historically, now I can look at Solomon Maimon and I now can say, one second, Rabbi B in M is none other than Rabbi Bear in Mizrich. Which means that Solomon Maimon is the earliest person to give us evidence of the Magid. So what happened when he went there? What did he see? And he continues to tell us. At last I arrived in, we now can fill in the blank. Where? Mizrich. At last I arrived in Mizrich, and after having rested from my journey, I went to the house of the superior. Remember, when he says superior, he means the Rebbe. Under the idea that I'd be introduced to him at once. I was told, however, that he could not speak to me at the time, but that I was invited to his table on Sabbath, along with the other strangers who had come to visit him. What does that sound like? Right, that is the forerunner of the Tish. That's when I'll interact with the superior, with the Rebbe. That I should then have the happiness of seeing the saintly man face to face and of hearing the sublimest teachings out of his own mouth. That although this was a public audience, yet on account of the individual references which I should find made to myself, I might regard it as a special interview. So Solomon Maimon, writing some 20 years later, remembers that he was prepped that on Sabbath you will have a personal interview in a public forum. And at this interview, the two senses that will be used are, which two senses? I highlighted them for you. Sight and sound. Sound, we'll come back to sound, but we'll also talk a little bit about sight. Accordingly, on Sabbath I went to this solemn meal, and I found there a large number of respectable men who had met here from various quarters. At length the great man appeared, and now he describes what he sees, in his awe-inspiring form, clothed in white satin, even his shoes and snuffbox were white, while this being among the Kabbalists the colour of grace, he gave to every newcomer his salam, that is, his greeting. So what did he say? Shalom Aleichem. Shalom Aleichem. He said, Shalom Aleichem, 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 Shalom Aleichem. Said to every person, said to them, Shalom Aleichem. and everything's white. Remember this, those of you who'll last the journey with me, in our third lecture we'll come back to this whiteness and what's going on, why is he dressed in white, in the manner of the Kabbalists. I will say, in a cheeky voice, I always wondered whether the snuff was also white. Okay. We sat down to the table and during the meal, what's the soundscape? What's going on at that time? We sat down at the meal, during the meal, look at that. A solemn silence reigned. That's going to be very important for us today. A solemn silence reigned. After the meal was over, the superior struck up a solemn, inspiring melody. Inspiriting melody. Held his hand for some time above on his brow and then began to call out. And I can't help but wondering, is this Zusha of Honey Polly? Could it be? Don't know. Of Raish. Who's that? Don't know. And so on. Every newcomer was thus called by his own name and the name of his residence, which excited no little astonishment. Each recited, as he was called, some verse of the Holy Scriptures. Thereupon, the superior began to deliver a sermon for which the verses recited served as a text, so that although they were disconnected verses taken from different parts of the Holy Scriptures, they were combined with as much skill as if they had formed a single whole. What was still more extraordinary, every one of the newcomers believed that he discovered in that part of the sermon, which was founded on his verse, something that had special reference to the facts of his own spiritual life. And this we were, of course, greatly astonished. So he describes this spontaneous experience. And what could be more spontaneous than the Magid not preparing a text, but him walking in. Gabriella, tell me a verse. Naomi, tell me a verse. Brian, tell me a verse. Right, each person, give me a verse. And with each of those verses, then weaving a Dvar Torah together live.
Second City.
Improv. Ah, okay. I'm not from Chicago. Sorry. Right, not part of my collective memory. Okay. So this is a great passage, I think, where he describes what was going on. I particularly want to pay attention to what he says here about the soundscape. There's a solemn silence, and then there's the melody. So he's very aware of what he's hearing, and there seems to be an accepted way of movements are at this meal. Solomon Maimon, writing 20 years later, says, you know what, I was very impressed then when I was a little kid. Looking back, Mr. Rationalist, I can now look back and say, you know what, he was just very good at guessing people. He probably had a network of spies, and he's very skeptical, and he ends the chapter by saying, the Hasidim are a bunch of charlatans. Whether we like Solomon Maimon's conclusion or not, his testimony of what actually happened is invaluable because he happens to be the only non-Hasidic testimony that we have of the Maggid of Mizrich. Now, it could be that in the archives in Poland, Ukraine, or Russia, there may be a document from before 1772 that mentions the Maggid's name, which would also be very good evidence and would help us understand who the Maggid was. As yet, such documents have not been found. If anybody's got some free time and would like to go through these archives, it would be a worthy project if you found something. Let's put Solomon Maimon aside and let's go back to the Torah that we learnt. V'haya v'atak chuli menagen. And now take from me a musician, a minstrel. V'ya kenagen ha-menagen. And it will be when the minstrel plays Vatiya Lav Yad Hashem, and then the hand of God will be upon him. And we focused on the Torah of the Magid, that Kenagen Hamanagen, that was not from the PowerPoint, right? Kenagen Hamanagen, this idea of being like an instrument, of being a tool, but focusing on specifically on the soundscape of the Magid. Is everybody familiar with the term soundscape? Would anybody like to explain the term soundscape? Soundscape is what we can hear in the surrounding area. So if we're here, the soundscape of our learning in the Beit Midrash, besides my voice and your participation, it might be the fact that we can hear some of the cars going along Pierre Koenig, right? Or we might hear that's the soundscape. If we hear a lecture during the week, the soundscape of the lecture might be someone's telephone ring. If we hear a drasha on Shabbat in an environment where people are keeping Shabbat, then telephones are not part of that soundscape. Okay, so soundscape is not referring to, it's like landscape, but sound. Are we clear on the term now? And that's where I want to take our discussion with the remaining time that we have to talk a little bit about the Magid soundscape and how that impacts what we know about the Magid and what Chassidus has given us. Any questions to this point? I want to move voices, if we're talking about soundscape. If until now I've been primarily interested in the historicity of the Magid and what we have as far as testimony, now I'm interested in the legacy and the teachings of the Magid, and that's where I'd like to take our discussion today. The work before you is a work known as Beit Rebbe. It is an early, printed in 1902 in Berdichev. And this work is an early biography of the Bala Tanya, his son and his grandson, the first three generations of Chabad rabbis. Why do I say Chabad and not Lubavitch? Does anybody know? Are they the same thing? Well, actually, the son was in Lubavitch. Okay? And the first one was in Liadi, never was in Lubavitch. But Chabad is the philosophy, Lubavitch is the name of the city. The Hasidic philosophy was set out in this work known as the Tanya. And there were a number of different schools or a number of different Hasidic groups that continued this Chabad philosophy. The only one that is extant today is Lubavitch. And therefore, in modern parlance, the terms are often used interchangeably. Or Chabad, and they're fantastic at marketing. Lubavitch doesn't go over well in Israel, and therefore they'll know them. They're known in Israel as Chabad. In the outside of Israel, going back 50 years, Lubavitch was the term that they used. Chabad, however, is a broader term than Lubavitch, and actually included other Hasidic groups, for instance, Liadi, Kopust, Bobrusk, Niezen, a few other groups that were all of this Chabad style and descendants of the Baal HaTanya, Rabbi Schneer Zalman of Liadi. So in this biography, 1902, we have a number of different stories, including the following story. Harav HaKadosh Rav Aaron Mikarlin. Who's Rav Aaron Mikarlin? Who's heard of Rav Aaron Mikarlin? What can you tell us about? What's your name?
Rebecca.
You've heard of Rav Aaron Mikarlin. Can anyone tell me anything about Rav Aaron of Karlin? The song that you walked into that was playing in the background, the soundscape that you walked into when you walked into the Beit Midrash, was the Zemer Ka Echsof. Ya Echsof Noam Shabbat. Oh, da, di, da, da. That Nigun the words of that nigun were written by Rav Aaron of Karlin. And Rav Aaron of Karlin was a student of the Magid, and he died at a very young age. He actually predeceased the Magid. He died in the same year of the Magid as the Magid, 1772. The Magid died at the end in December 72. Rav Aaron died as a young man. And today, there are two dynasties that continue the legacy of Rav Aaron of Karlin. One of them is known as Karlin Stolin, and the other one is known as Pinsk Karlin. Two different dynasties that continue this legacy, but the tune, Ka'echsov, is a very popular tune, and you heard it when you came in. Rav Aaron Agadol Mikarlin, Migdolei Talmidei Harav HaMagid, V'niftar B'chayei Harav HaMagid, and it says when he passed away on Chol HaMoed Pesach, he was a student of the Magid, and he died at Chol HaMoed Pesach in 1772. And Beis Rebbe, in this work, we have the following tale about him. Pam achat, once, b'Shabbat Kodesh b'Laila, this is Friday night, Shayu haChaverim Yoshvim b'Yachad v'Chozrim haDivrei Torah. And the friends, the Chevra, were sitting together and they were going over the Divrei Torah. Which Divrei Torah are they going over?
The Magid,
right? That fascinating Dvar Torah where the Magid weave together all these different psukim, and so they're going over it. V'arav Rav Aaron Yashav b'chadrei b'fnei atzmai. And Rav Aaron HaGadol is sitting in his own room. Usfatav hayu merachashim. And his lips were mumbling. In other words, he's saying something. What is he saying? We don't really know what he's saying. It seems to be some type of davening, right? Some type of prayer or something like that. We don't know exactly what it is. Pitom, suddenly, Shamu kol dofek badelet. They heard someone banging at the door. Mimashoresh shel Rav HaMagid, the servant of the Magid, V'omar, and he said, this is what the servant says, Heichan bekan harav Rav Aaron. Where is Rav Aaron? Hine Rabbeinu Tziva, our master commanded. Who's our master? The Magid. The Magid commanded, Tifsukumi loymar shir ashirim. Stop saying shir ashirim. Why? Ki bashir ashirim shalachem atem mar ishim oylamos. You are mar ishim. What's mar ishim? Making a noise, making a tumult in supernal worlds, for Rabbeinu eino yochol lishon el ze, and our master can't fall asleep because you're making such a tumult in the in supernal worlds. No one else could hear the Magid, could hear Rav Aaron, except for the Magid, because the sound wasn't a sound that he was making that ever was audible. It was spiritually audible. We see over here in this tale a certain sensitivity that the Magid has to the sounds around him. You with me? Let's add another story to that salad. Not a story, before a story, a Torah. In a work called Likutim Yekarim, which is a gathering of different Torahs attributed to the Magid, we have the following Torah, the following passage that describes how a person should focus during prayer. One of the great challenges to this very day is how to focus in prayer. Someone once came to my father with a problem at the beginning of davening. He said, I've got this problem in business, maybe you can help me. My father said, look, I'm happy to think about it, but I'm about to start davening. The person said to him, I find that I solve most of my problems by the time I get to Shema Koleinu. Well, what happens in davening? We think about everything except davening. That's the biggest challenge. So the Magid has a passage over here where he says to the person, when a person's trying to cleave to God, when a person's trying to focus in prayer, and there'll be times that you fall and you get sidetracked. But if you're so focused that even when you get sidetracked, you'll bring yourself back. which today is standard meditative practice, by the way. People say if you're doing meditation and you get sidetracked and mind starts to wander, gently bring it back. That's what the Maggid says over here. And the Maggid gives instructions about the surroundings. What type of place should you be in so that will help you focus? And that's what I want to look at the moment. Look at the last two lines. V'tzarich shelo yeh shum adam b'oto bayit k'shorotzeh ledabek. When a person wants to cleave to God, he has to be in a place where there's nobody else in the house. Why nobody else in the house? A distraction. What do you mean? There'll be a distraction? If I'm in this room and you're in another room, what's the distraction? There's noise, a person might come in. There's some distraction. You have to be totally alone, says the Maggid, in the house if you really want to be focused. Sha'afilu tziftzufei ofot yucholim levatlo. That even the chirping of a bird can take the focus of a person. Notice which sense the Maggid is focusing on here. Sound. It's not that he's worried that there will be someone who's going to walk in front of you. He's worried that there'll be a tziftzuf, there'll be a chirping of a bird that will take a person's focus away. B'shnat Taf Kuf Tzadik Zayin or Taf Kuf Tzadik Chet. Around 1838, Hayu Berusland Harbe Sreifos Rachmana Litzlan. In Russia there were many fires, heaven forfend. Hainu Harbe Ayaros Nisrafu Balabasesh. There were many villages that just were totally burnt by the flames. Gambaber Dichev Uva Ayarot Svivot Rujin Hayu Sreifos. Also in Berdichev and the surrounding villages near Ruzhin, there were fires. But there was one place where there were no fires. Where? Rak beRuzhin loy haya sreifa. Only in Ruzhin there were no fires. Ufamachas. Holacha tzadik hakodesh latayel. The holy tzadik went for a walk. Who's the holy tzadik? This is referring to Rabbi Yisrael of Ruzhin, who happens to be the great-grandson of the Maggid. And he goes for a walk, al pnei hasadeh, he goes for a walk out into nature. V'holchu imay gam anoshim chasidim. When the Rebbe goes for a walk into nature, you want to go also. So he's going in for a walk in nature together with the chasidim. Uvaderech halicha, and as they're walking, Omar echad mehem, one of them said, "Bechol hasvivos hayu sreifos, rak beRuzhin loyaya." You know, it's interesting. In all the surrounding villages, there've been fires this year. Only in our village, in Ruzhin, there've been no fires. Vayiki shmei atzadek estvarav. When Rabbi Yisrael of Ruzhin heard this person what he said, he said the following. Hamagid mimezrich haya soine ra'ashim v'ra'amim. Dinnering, what's that? Thunder. The Maggid did not like thunder. V'haya b'kayitz echad harbe ra'ashim v'ra'amim. There was one summer where there was lots of thunder. Kimat b'chol olam. Except in one place. Where?
Mizrich.
Except for in Mizrich. Ufam achas hayu chasidim beveisoi, and once the chasidim were in his house, in the Maggid's house, and one of the chasidim said, you know, in all the world, this year is a year that there's a lot of thunder going on. And you know, here in Mizrich, we haven't heard any thunder. Va'acharei dvorav yoma yomayim, a day or two after his words, what happened? Hitchilu haramim gam beMizrich. There was also thunder in Mizrich. What do you think is going to happen now in Ruzhin? Hadiburim yotzo mipiv hakadosh. The words went from the holy mouth of the Rabbi Saul of Ruzhin. V'achar yom o yomayim, and after a day or two, hayos reifa g'doyla b'ruzhin, there was a big fire in Ruzhin. Kimat kol habotim shebe'ir nisrafu, all the houses in Ruzhin were burnt, except for one. Rak beis, beis shel atzadik hakadosh Rabbi Yisrael of Ruzhin lo nisraf, only the house of Rabbi Yisrael of Ruzhin was not burnt. And the storyteller concludes, I was there, straight after the fires. And they told me this story. Why do I bring this story? What's the Magid? Does he want to avoid? Sound. This sensitivity to sound. In Lubavitch tradition as well, that's the Ruzhin tradition. Moving to a different Hasidic group, Lubavitch. And Lubavitch is a very different Hasidic group that's beyond the scope of this series. They also have a tradition that the Magid, they don't say that he didn't like thunder. What do they have? Hayo yore miram. He was scared of thunder. V'loy shoma ram me'olam. And he didn't hear thunder ever. This sensitivity to sound, we have another source.
If he never ever heard thunder, how did they know he was afraid of it?
Excellent question. But not for a Hasidic story. That's a Talmudic question. What do we have? Let's say any questions to this point? Comments? Please. Is what, sorry?
That's what he's trying to meditate on.
Could very well be. I want to put these threads together in a moment. It could be. Yes. Yes, that is the theme of that story. I brought the right Al Tiftach Pela Satan, meaning don't open your mouth because that will precipitate. That's the word I was looking for, to precipitate evil. That's definitely the theme of those two stories. I brought the story for a different reason. I brought the story because of the sensitivity to sound, or as I've called it, the Magid's soundscape. And I want to put the threads together in a second. Any other comments or questions before I bring it together? Put it together. Now's your chance. Okay. Let's have a look at what we've got and try and put the picture together. Kenagen Hamanagen. We began our journey today by talking about the way the Magid said that a person should be an instrument, that they should be a tool for God, they should be a medium for God's voice, rather than sitting and planning exactly what you're going to say. Let God speak through you. We added to that that one of the Magid's students, Rav Uziel Meislish, on the verse Kashofar Harem Kolecha, he added that your voice should be raised like a shofar. And a shofar also is another way, as a musical instrument. The shofar doesn't think about other things. The shofar makes the sound without thinking, am I making a nice sound? Is it coming out clearly? The shofar just is the tool for the mitzvah. If we go back to Solomon Maimon's testimony, when he walks in there and on Shabbat he sits down, and what catches Solomon Maimon's ear? The first thing that catches his ear is the silence. And then Solomon Maimon notes that there's a melody. The soundscape of the Magid is what Solomon Maimon, writing 20 years later, still remembers. If we add to that, Rav Aaron HaGadol Mikarlin, his Shir HaShirim, that wakes the Magid, that won't let the Magid sleep. That's the very same Rav Aaron HaGadol who wrote a zemer called Ka Echsof that we heard when we walked in today. And let me make a point about that, my friends. When was Mirot written? Is this a phenomenon in the late 18th century, Poland?
Long before that.
No one's writing Zmirot then. Zmirot, when's the golden age of Zmirot?
16th century?
Earlier. Right? The golden age of Zmirot takes us back to Spain, the Middle Ages. That's when we have the great poets. And you only need to walk around Rachavia, and you go from one poet to the next. Dunash, you've got Dunash, who's only got a little street, but he's got a very big zemer. What zemer did Dunash ben Labrat write? Dror Yikra, very good. The Dalit gives it away. Right? This is the period that people are writing Zmirot. It's true that then there'll be new Zmirot written with the Kabbalists. But by the 18th century, no one's writing Zmirot. And the truth is, even though Kai Echsof's a beautiful zemer, it doesn't have the same meter, it doesn't have a rhyme the way the earlier Zmirot have. And anybody who's tried to sing it around their table, it's a beautiful song, but it's not so easy. I can tell you that here at Pardes, my Hasidus class, we work months on learning that zemer. We do other things as well. But we open up the class for the first couple of months just trying to learn how to sing this zemer, which is such a rare phenomenon. And it's a student of the Magid that composes a zemer for Shabbos. If we add to that the chirping of the birds that the Magid said, I don't want to hear this chirping of the birds. The chirping of the birds that disturbs a person from their focus. And finally, the Magid's aversion, he doesn't want to hear thunder. He's very sensitive to his spiritual soundscape and his physical soundscape. Putting these threads together, I'd like to suggest this evening that we have here an aspect of the Magid's biography that has yet to be recorded, yet to be highlighted. The Magid sensitivity to sound, spiritual sensitivity to sound, which is perhaps a precursor to the Hasidic approach to music. One of the things that the Hasidim will become identified with in later generations is music. So much so that there'll be even a genre known as Hasidic music. And we know that the Hasidim are famous for using music as a spiritual path, as a tool. And there's many Torot, there's many different explanations of why music can help a person reach different spiritual levels, of why music is more powerful in some ways than prayer. Prayer is limiting. It's got words. A nigun. You can soar with a nigun. You can get wherever you want to go. And I'd like to suggest that what we know as Hasidic music starts already with the Magid. With the Magid's sensitivity to what the sounds will be of the Hasidim. It's a suggestion. It's a suggestion because you've noticed I've weaved together different types of sources, hagiographic sources, sources from outside Hasidus, sources from students. But the tapestry that I've tried to present to you today offers us a window into the early Hasidic movement, tells us something about the Magid's legacy. And although we opened up our class and we said, the Magid, we don't know what he looked like. He didn't write anything. But he left us a certain soundscape. A sensitivity to sound. A sensitivity to music. And this sound will continue to reverberate to this very day. Is this the only thing that we know about the Maggid? Is this the only legacy that he left us? For the answer to that question, you'll have to come back in 2 weeks' time when we'll continue the journey. We'll leave it there for tonight.